It is with pleasure that I introduce Professor Margaret Washington as part of our series today, focusing on her new book, Sojourner's Truth, America, published by the University of Illinois Press. The book is outside, and please just be ready to get it for signature after the presentation. Professor Margaret Washington is not a stranger to Africana. She is a member of our field. She's been here for many years, and a colleague that taught courses, cross-listed, been in many of our functions and conferences. But I still think it's important that we mention a few of the facts that she's a professor of American history and American studies and has been at Cornell since 1988. Professor Washington is specialized in African-American history and culture, African-American women, and the American South. She also teaches on race and popular culture. Her publication, I will mention a few, includes the book we're celebrating today, Sojourner Truth America, Narratives of Sojourner Truth, which is published by Vintage Books, and A Peculiar People, a Slave Religion and Community Culture Among the Gulas, and published by New York University Press. Professor Washington has also published numerous articles on black history and culture. She's a noted also public historian. Many of you must have seen her on television programs where she worked as a historical consultant. And these include documentaries such as When the Lion Wrote History, The Life of Frederick Douglass. She was also featured in a film entitled Liberty, The Story of the American Revolution, another film called Africans in America, and also The Magical Legacy of Gula Culture. Another one is John Brown's Holy War, and also Abraham and Mary Lincoln, A House Divided. So these are just some of the few projects that she works on. She was also a historical consultant for Sundance Award-winning film festival, Daughters of the Dust, Julie Dash, one that I'm sure many of you have seen. She also appeared in many television documentaries on Lincoln's Gettysburg, and the Discovery Channels, among many, many other public television programs. Her book, which we are featuring today, was recently awarded, and we must congratulate her on this, the 2009 Letitia Woods Brown Memorial Award by the Association for Black Women Historians. So without any further delay, please join me in welcoming Professor Margaret Washington.
Thank you. Where are the lights? Lights. Thanks you, and thank you for coming. Sorry about the delay, but technology is not what it used to be. And the PowerPoint is not essential to my talk, but I always like to end with images of Sojourner Truth because it really is part of her story. I'm a social historian of the black experience, and I try to write history from the bottom up. While I do that, and while I focus on the black experience, I don't look at history or black history in a vacuum. I feel that it's important to integrate the black experience with the American experience. And that's what I did with Sojourner Truth. That's why it's called Sojourner Truth's America, because in an important way, it's just as much about the times as it is about Sojourner. I'm also a revisionist historian, and social history and history from the bottom up is fairly self-explanatory. I hope it will be in the presentation. But I just want to say a few things about revisionism. By revisionist, I mean that in significant respects, I'm disagreeing, or I should say taking issue with some of the things, actually many of the things that have previously been written about her that have encouraged me to reassess the life of Sojourner Truth based on more, in my opinion, substantial research. So this afternoon I hope to do three things, but I think I'll probably end up only doing two because we've spent a considerable amount of time trying to figure out the third thing. I want to talk about Sojourner's life and her significance. And I wanted to present some images, and I wanted to present Sojourner Truth from the perspective of images, because There's one thing I agree with the historian Nell Painter about, and that, although I don't agree with her analysis, I agree with her assessment that remembering Sojourner Truth is remembering imagery in the mid-19th century. And then the third thing that I want to do is to give you a sense of my revisionist approach to Sojourner's life. And there's lots of revisionism in the book, and I won't get to all of it, but there are a couple that I think are fairly significant. One is the Ain't I a Woman speech, and the other one is Sojourner's relationship to the African-American community. The spectacular array of color and light in a rural eastern New York autumn dawn is best enjoyed inside by a cozy fire. Until the sunshine's brilliance mitigated the frosty chill in the air and dried the dew from the grasses, only the enslaved domestics and field workers, and perhaps the more conscientious yeomen, stirred in the semi-darkness. Normally, by sunrise, Belle had lit the fires, had the morning meal in progress, and was busy with other domestic chores. But one autumn morning in 1826, the household awoke to find Belle gone. Slipping out the back door, she crept past the poultry she would no longer feed, past cows she had milked for the last time, and sheep in the meadow whose wool she never again expected to spin. She carried a knapsack of provisions, meager clothing and shoes, because bare feet were essential to her silent escape. She had a secure grasp on Sophia, her nursing baby. Faithful, accommodating, cheerful Belle was fleeing the house of bondage. She told her partner, Thomas, that she was leaving and charged her eldest daughter, Diana, with looking after her little sister, Elizabeth. Belle was not sure where to go, but she knew some people in Ulster County abhorred slavery, and God would direct her. After all, her talk with God inspired her to leave John Dumont, the man who had owned her since she was 12. It was a strange move for Belle, not only because she was faithful and obedient, as trained by her parents, but also because the New York Emancipation Law would take effect in just over a year, on July 4, 1827, whereby all adult slaves would be free. But Dumont had promised that if she worked hard, he would free Belle and Thomas, her partner, a year early and build them a little cabin. This inspired Belle to step up her labor so much that one day in the field, she cut off her index finger. Dumont insisted that she lost too much time because of it, and he refused to give her her free papers. She asked for spiritual guidance. "Do you think that's right, God?" she said. The Spirit assured her that it was not, so she determined to claim the promise, having decided to leave just before the day dawned, as the Spirit had directed her. She was not going far, for she was not a runaway, but she needed an advocate for the moment of moral confrontation which she knew would come when her owner arrived to take her and her baby back. She went to an anti-slavery Quaker named Levi Rowe. He was gravely ill, and he had her taken to a man in the neighborhood of her birth, someone she knew well. His name was Isaac Van Wagenen, a Dutch man around her age, which was 29. Dumont found Belle the same day. "Well, so you run away from me." "I didn't run away. I walked by daylight. And all because you promised me a year of my time. Well, you must come back with me." "No, I won't go back." "Then I shall take the child." "You can't have my child. You know, you can go to jail for breaking the law," he said. "I can do that," she said, "but I won't go back." Finally, Isaac Van Wagenen interceded, offering Dumont $20 for Belle's year of service and $5 for the baby. Dumont finally agreed and left. Belle was free. The Dutch family held a ceremony to commemorate the emancipation, and Belle claimed a new name in her transition. She became known as Isabella Van Wagenen until 1843, when she had an epiphany and became Sojourner Truth. Sojourner Truth is exceptional by any standards. She overcame crucibles of race, gender, poverty, lack of education, and enslavement. She bridged cultural, intellectual, and religious differences between herself and middle-class white and black progressives. Most of all, she connected with common folk of both races with her homespun humor, using country life and scripture parables as commentary on the times. There was both power and sweetness in that great warm soul and that vigorous frame, wrote her friend from Detroit, Reverend Samuel Rogers. In the mid-19th century, the American public was in earnest about its demands for good public speakers, said the Lyceum organizer William F. Powell. And Sojourner Truth took the people by storm. Of all the strong characters I met on the platform, he said, none were stronger than Sojourner Truth, whose eloquence was only matched by her wit. She was extemporaneous, tense, vigorous, and a great smoker. She would swing out one long arm, walking back and forth and gesticulating as she struck out the straightforward logic of intuitive nature. Sojourner felt that her life was enveloped in divine dispensation and often insisted that she rarely knew what she was going to say before the words came out. Nonetheless, her friend, Gilbert Haven, Bishop of the Methodist Episcopal Church, dubbed her the Queen of the Platform. She was born in slavery in 1797 in the Hudson Valley and named Isabella by her mother. She was never educated and never went to church, but her mother passed on to Belle, as she was called, a deep sense of faith, a combination of mysticism from the African heritage and pietism gleaned from the spiritual ambiance of the Dutch female domestic sphere. Belle inherited her strength, capacity for labor, and her 6-foot frame from her father, the towering Bomb Free, as he was called, who was reportedly half Mohawk Indian. They were the kitchen family of a Dutch patroon whose land holdings once measured 2 million acres. So Dutch was Belle's native tongue, and she did not learn English well until moving to Manhattan around the age of 31. She always spoke English with a Dutch brogue. She had 5 slave owners, and the last one, John Dumont, owned her for nearly 18 years. She had 2 enslaved partners and 5 children. She labored in the house, outside of the house, and in the fields, and reportedly had the stamina of 2 or 3 people. That wench is better to me than a man, Dumont would brag. And as Sojourner Truth said in that famous Akron, Ohio speech, I have mowed and sowed and husked and planted and plowed and reaped. And can any man do more than that? In 1826, Isabella's uncharacteristic boldness in taking her freedom was only the beginning of her assertiveness. After she left Dumont, she found out that he had sold her 5-year-old son, Peter, to his nephew, and then his nephew had sold him south to his brother-in-law. This was illegal, since the child, once he reached adulthood by New York law, would be free. She raised a tremendous ruckus in the neighborhood. Local Quakers alerted the Manumission Society in New York City. Quakers also gave her money to hire a lawyer, instructed her in going to court and in submitting kidnapping charges. It took a year, but amazingly, the child was returned. If you could have seen me back then, she said later, I was as ignorant as a horse in those days, not even knowing how to take an oath in court. I was barefoot, bareheaded, meanly clad. Only God could have made such people hear me. A religious conversion experience, success in regaining her son, and the fulfillment of a terrible curse, which I don't have time to discuss, instilled in Isabella a belief that she was chosen, gifted, and had a special mission. That inspired her to speak publicly, something almost unheard of for women. Local Methodists were impressed with her preaching despite her English. They took her to New York City, introduced her around, and helped her find domestic work. She spent 15 eventful years in New York City as Isabella Van Wagenen. She became a popular camp meeting preacher, a reformer among prostitutes, and in the city's slums. She got involved in a religious cult, was implicated in a murder charge, but handled herself with such aplomb that she successfully sued her accusers. But she learned a lesson. She never again accepted anyone's scriptural analysis at face value. And she preferred that children read scripture to her because they never offered interpretations. Isabella grew inert and spiritually malnourished in New York City, perhaps because of her own missteps, the constraints on female preaching, and certainly because of the apparent loss of her son at sea. On Pentecost Sunday, June 1st, 1843, at age 46, Isabella Van Wagenen announced her imminent departure to her employer and friend, Lucy Whiting. The Lord has given me a new name, and I'm going to go to a new home, Mrs. Whiting. Where are you going? I'm going east. Well, what does that mean? The Lord has directed me to go east and leave this city at once. Lucy was shocked. Belle, you're crazy. No, I ain't, she said. The Spirit calls me, and I must go. She had money in the bank, and she gave the Whitings more money to deposit, but she left the city with only a change of clothes and 25 cents for the Brooklyn Ferry, enough, she said, to pay Caesar. It was camp meeting season, and Sojourner was welcomed throughout Long Island because of her capacity for labor, her culinary skills, and most especially, her preaching. She later said that she preached religion and abolition all the way. From Springfield, Massachusetts, an abolitionist woman wrote her Boston friend, "There is an amazing colored woman who is taking Springfielders by storm. She cannot read or write, but the Spirit has taught her. And we are sending her on to Northampton." She settled outside of Northampton, Massachusetts, in a commune that was an Underground Railroad depot and an abolitionist headquarters for Garrisonian anti-slavery advocates. William Lloyd Garrison followers advocated immediate, unconditional emancipation. They condemned the white churches as the bulwarks of slavery, and they espoused a motto of no union with slaveholders. They also embraced many other reforms. This was America's communitarian moment, and Northampton was the most exceptional. Frederick Douglass, whom Sojourner Truth met at Northampton, said that at Northampton the air was full of isms: mesmerism, Grahamism, Fourierism, transcendentalism, communism, and abolitionism. It was the one place where my color was not an issue. The Northampton community advocated gender equality, and there Sojourner began speaking on women's rights. Her affiliation with this radical pacifist organization began her lifetime commitment to social justice. At the community speakout, she held audiences spellbound with her singing, her stories of bondage, her past persecutions by so-called Christians, her dealings with the Holy Spirit and false prophets, and her interpretation of scripture. "The Lord reveals everything to Sojourner," a teenage commune member wrote her father. Sojourner's conversations and sermons were laced with anecdotes and spirituality. She was also quick on her feet and humorous. "3/3 of the world are wrong," she once preached. "But that takes them all, Sojourner," someone shouted. "Oh, well, I'm sorry," she said. "I'd hoped that there'd be a few left." On another occasion, an emancipated man fell from the factory belfry. He landed safely on his feet between a large rock and the softest place on a platform. After many applications of cold water, which was one of the reforms that they engaged in, the man was fine. A woman wrote her husband, "Sojourner says that the devil made him fall, but the good Lord prepared a nice soft place for him to land upon." The abolitionists immediately recognized the verbal force and power of Sojourner's appeal. Less than 2 years after leaving New York City as a domestic, she was back as the first black woman to speak at the annual meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society. Soon she was speaking all over New England, often traveling alone on horseback. Her colorful witness was often painful, sometimes reeking with satire, and sometimes represented her own peculiar spin on English. Her associates recycled her homilies and in their own speeches. She was especially gifted in transforming scripture into double entendre to conform to the historical times. One example comes from a meeting in the 1840s chaired by the noted author Lydia Maria Child. The abolitionists there spoke about the evils of slavery and the importance of women being able to exercise free speech. "A gentleman in a white cloth who was a minister was so angry with Child," she said, "that his crimson face was glowing with excitement and indignation. Finally, he asked if he could exercise his free speech. Child invited him to the platform. As an Orthodox minister of the gospel, I came to hear some of the eloquence and wit, which I understand was so abundant at these meetings. But instead, I have thus far listened to little save insults heaped upon the clergy. This was my first anti-slavery meeting, and it would be my last." His wrath was rising, his face reddening, noted Child. "I can find better use of my leisure hours than attendance at gatherings where the only speakers are women and jackasses." The audience was stunned into dead silence. Then Sojourner rose slowly and addressed the chair. "Mrs. Chairman, the gentleman tells us that he's a minister of the gospel, so he probably knows what's in the scripture. Well, there was another minister a long time ago named Balaam. He got mighty mad too at an ass that spoke. But, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to remind the gentleman that it was the ass and not the minister who saw the angel. The minister certainly knew the story from the Old Testament book of Numbers. The Moab prince Balaam intended to disobey God and smite the children of Israel en route to the promised land. As Moab saddled his ass to ride against the Israelites, an angry Jehovah sent the archangel Michael with a sword to stand in the road in front of the ass. The angel was visible only to the ass, who stopped dead in her tracks. Moab continually smote the poor disobedient ass. God then gave the ass the power to speak, and she asked, "Why am I being punished? Don't you see that angel standing in the road with the sword?" Then God opened Moab's eyes, and he too saw the angel. Sojourner's message: because of Balaam's perversity, God had to work through an ass, just as he was working through abolitionists and women, while pro-slavery ministers perverted God's will, as did Balaam. Sojourner published her narrative in 1850, which went through several printings. With the proceeds, she financed her anti-slavery travels and purchased a home in Northampton for herself and her daughters. So there was a practical side to Sojourner. She was industrious, she was independent, and she thrived on being self-supporting. She could not read and write, but she could count, she could handle finances, and she valued having an abiding resting place in between her sojourns. In 1851, she traveled through upstate New York, and then she went on to Ohio, where she made her famous "Ain't I a Woman" speech in Akron, Ohio, the authenticity of which has been debated among historians. And this is one of my revisionist points. The speech that she gave, reported in the local anti-slavery newspaper, was different in tone from the one that feminist scholars have been citing since the 1970s. Frances Gage, who was the president of the Akron Convention, reported her speech 12 years later in 1863, and she made it in 1851. One historian compared Gage's account of the speech to the story of George Washington cutting down the cherry tree, that is, its folklore. He also insisted that Sojourner did not make an impression on the audience, and that the men were not hostile to women's rights, as Gage maintained in her recounting of this speech, and that no one wanted to prevent Sojourner from speaking, as Gage maintained as well. So in comparing the two versions, that is Frances Gage's version and the version that was published in the newspaper 2-3 weeks later, and in examining many other sources, because this speech was picked up by about 12 newspapers, I disagree with this assessment. In fact, I'm really surprised by Gage's recall. She certainly took some racist license, there's no question about that. She attributed, for example, a Southern dialect to Sojourner Truth, and Sojourner Truth had never been in the South. She attributed Sojourner Truth as using the N-word, which she never used. So she ad-libbed, and she misrepresented. No account also mentions that Sojourner spoke about motherhood or that she said she had 13 children. Gage picked this up from Harriet Beecher Stowe, who simultaneously, that is in 1863, wrote an account of her 1855 meeting of Sojourner Truth. So these two white authors are basically appropriating Sojourner's voice giving their voice to Sojourner Truth, and at a time that's long past when they actually met her for the first time. Even with those caveats, nonetheless, the substance of the address matches contemporary accounts. Sojourner's impact on the audience and male hostility is well documented. And there is newspaper evidence that a very prominent white woman did not want Sojourner on the platform. There was a tall, colored woman at the meeting selling books, she said, and she should not have been there. But she didn't mention the fact that Sojourner Truth spoke, actually, she spoke twice. And as for the refrain, "Ain't I a Woman," Sojourner probably said something similar. And Frances Gage, like Harriet Beecher Stowe, was a novelist and a poet. And so she was taking literary license as well by creating this phrase, "Ain't I a Woman?" But I think Sojourner said something quite similar, if not the refrain, "Ain't I a Woman?" Because at that time, The repetitive refrain that was used by anti-slavery women was, "Am I not a woman and a sister?" The New York Tribune, which also covered the Akron meeting and also was very impressed by Sojourner's words, said that Sojourner Truth said she was a woman. So clearly she said something similar to that. And to attribute Sojourner's words to folklore is essentially ahistorical, in my opinion. She was in Ohio for 2 years, this brought her recognition not only among the Western anti-slavery advocates, but in the East because of the newspapers. Her travels were being covered more than any other anti-slavery woman of the time, and that was the case throughout her life. When she did leave, the radical anti-slavery women in Ashtabula County gave her a beautiful, huge white silk banner with their name on it and the logo, "Am I Not a Woman and a Sister?" in recognition of her Akron speech. By the time she reached the East in 1853, her Ohio reputation had preceded her because of her Akron address and also because of a confrontation she had with Frederick Douglass, which again I have to skip over, but hopefully if we get to the images I can mention it at that point. But at any rate, by the time she got back to the East in 1853, she was what was called an opener, which means that on the platform of the anti-slavery movements, when there would be something like 8 to 10 people who were going to speak, there would be someone who would speak first, and that was the opener. And so Sojourner Truth had become, rather than someone who was sort of a backup, she was now an opener. Sojourner's greatest personal triumph was speaking to her own people. And again, this is one of my revisionist perspectives. She did this in Ohio, but I think for her the most significant aspect of speaking before African Americans was when she did it in New York, because she was, of course, a New Yorker. This was her starting place, and so it was very important for her to be speaking in New York City. The idea that Sojourner Truth was not held in high regard by people of her own race is something that I disagree with, and both of the other two biographers of Sojourner Truth have maintained that. It was not a large gathering at the Colored Congregational Church because the New York Tribune had given the wrong address in the advertisement, but it was a substantial, mostly colored audience and a sprinkling of whites, the New York Tribune said. Everyone listened attentively. Sojourner Truth spoke to the audience and told them that she felt it was very difficult to speak to people of her own race and that she was in solidarity with them. She had been enslaved like many of them were. She was tied up and whipped till the blood trickled down her back, she told them. My young husband was whipped until his blood flowed for a mile in the snow, and my beloved father was allowed to freeze to death. Yes, I had begged God to kill all the white people and not leave anything for seed. But eventually, faith bound me to mercy in a Christian spirit of forgiveness. We really have no choice, we black people. God will punish the whites. And I have high hopes for that time of retribution, for that day of judgment. Because in spite of the way we have been treated, she said, I live and God lives within me. And there was loud applause. She also talked about the time she came to New York City. I was ignorant, and I couldn't speak English very well, but I did not bow to the filth of the city. I went around with a white lady who had brought me, and I determined to learn all I could. I had grown up without knowing anything. I didn't even know Jesus Christ was the Son of God, but I did know God, and that was a starting point for me. I discovered a wondrous spirituality, she said, and I wanted to go among my own colored people and do good. But they rebuffed me, she said, and they sent me away crying. Then she started talking about skin color. I used to wonder, she said, why am I black? If I was born white, I could have plenty of food and clothes. But now I glory in my color, and I am well satisfied with the color that God has been pleased to give me. And what have we done, we black people, that we should be hated, she said. The answer is skin color. But we have not made ourselves black, and yet whites victimize us. And they victimize us by saying we are lazy and careless about our own rights, and the oppressor binds us hand and foot, and then they ask us why we do not run. She insisted that even black moral lapses were the products of prejudice and the lack of opportunity. These facts, she said, speak for themselves. The blood and sweat and tears drawn from the black people were sufficient to cover the earth all over the United States. And it is difficult to forgive whites, yet she urged her people to go forward in a spirit of hope and race progress. Her own humble history and presence exemplify the power of faith, strength, and human will. She was purchasing a home now, she said. She had purchased her life, published her life story. She had spoken to multitudes throughout the North. She, who was born in slavery, born with nothing, and emancipated with nothing but character, thrift, and an abiding faith. And she ended by calling for action among her people. Blacks have a responsibility to join white reformers, she said, and speak out publicly for our rights. She exhorted her people to stir. Don't let the white people have it all to themselves. And she denounced smug, do-nothing blacks who were seemingly satisfied with their lot and not caring about their other people. There was more than one kind of bondage, she said, and black people needed to be restrained from just caring about each other. And she urged black women to take a stand and demand their rights. As a colored woman, she said, I want all the rights to which I am entitled. Her address, said the Tribune, occupied a considerable amount of time and excited considerable interest and popularity. Although she did not do a lucrative business with her book among this working class population, she passed her narrative around and sold several copies. Later that month, Sojourner spoke at Abyssinian Baptist Church. And her talk there reflected her growing influence among African Americans. A large audience of colored people filled the sanctuary. Sojourner unfurled her banner that she had been given by the Ashtabula Female Anti-Slavery Society. Am I not a woman and a sister was at the heading. Underneath this statement was a kneeling figure of a black woman with lifted hands, and below it the lines, how long, O Lord, how long? A million and a half women in chains. Shall we heed these wrongs? Will not the righteous God be avenged upon? Such a nation as this. An elderly colored man opened the meeting with a prayer, and Sojourner sang a hymn. I am pleading for my people, a poor, downtrodden race. She then delivered her most secular and controversial lecture to a black audience on record. There was a time, she said, when her people did all the common work, but gradually, whites pushed blacks out of every unskilled occupation. Now, white folks clean boots and wait tables. Whites also lay about lazy and beg vigils. I have to say we used to do a little of that, too. Humor was one of her most deft tactics for winning over an audience, and the audience laughed. Speaking with anti-immigrant bias, she said that since Irish laborers had been replaced with blacks, the city's streets were not very clean. Thick layers of dirt covered New York, she said, producing flies that invaded the shop and even got in people's eyes. It wasn't like that when black people were cleaning the streets, she said. She observed that dirt, mud, and filth had hardened on the streets, and whites had to use picks and crows to pick it up. The audience laughed. Unemployment, she said, is not funny, and she grew serious. Like other leaders, she was concerned about her people's plight. She talked about going into the area of Philadelphia that was being settled by farmers. People are not going to hire colored people as coachmen and barbers in New York City anymore, she said. And now we have to go elsewhere. While Frederick Douglass and other black leaders were advocating black manual labor school, Sojourner Truth followed the black Westerner solution of immigration, not colonization. For they would not be driven out of America. When I was lately lecturing out in Pennsylvania, she said, farmers wanted good men and women willing to work their farms on shares. If colored people go out there, she said, depend on it. In the course of time, we will become independent. We could save our money, buy land, and become self-sufficient. She had witnessed and experienced a lifetime of personal and historical transformation, and she did not have much patience with blacks who abhorred leaving their home environments. And she reminded them of her own example once again. How long ago was it that a colored woman could stand before a white audience of over 1,000 people and be listened to with respect and attention? And she urged blacks to be law-abiding. "Don't be like white people," she said. "We must never stoop to the level of whites." Then Sojourner spoke to black preachers, condemning their hierarchy and their exclusion of black women. She urged ministers to stop focusing on events thousands of years ago and make the word flesh by helping humanity. "It was so much easier to go to Europe," she said, "among the dry bones of pharaohs and mummies, than to deal with the stern realities of the living present." She criticized the superfluous ostentation of church buildings, big lumbering things, she said, taking up costly space and doing no good. Churches filled a third of their capacity once a week, she said, while hosts of destitute citizens reside in low dens and skylighted garrets. Why not lodge people in these immense empty structures that were a dead loss most of the time? And she mercilessly satirized black male clerical opposition to women speaking in public. "You big Greek cram mouthing men, for many a long century you've been befogging the world and getting its affairs into the most terrible snarl of confusion. Yet when women spoke, ministers cried, 'Shame, shame on women.'" She urged her black sisters to seize their special mission, move forward, and not leave it all to the white women. And in a mocking role reversal, she asserted that women, not men, were peculiarly adapted to fill the talking professions. "Men," she ribbed, "should no longer unsex themselves by leaving the plow and the plane for the pulpit and the platform. Women," she said, "should set matters in general aright and then keep it so. We must set them aright. We must get to work and drag the world right side up, disentangling it from the snarl which men have willfully gotten it into. Women would only be resourceful, united, and resolute when they put their shoulders to the wheel." No one was laughing now. Shock was another of Sojourner's strategies, and she challenged the women and the men to make their race better. By 1856, Sojourner was back in Ohio again. In 1857, she sold her Northampton home. She had bought a lot next to her home and moved to Battle Creek, Michigan. She remained in Battle Creek, Michigan for the rest of her life, but she continued to travel. The anti-slavery movement had migrated west because of the Kansas issue, and Sojourner migrated with it. She became a Wolverine, as she said, and worked out of Battle Creek, Michigan, and also out of Detroit, Michigan. Battle Creek, Michigan was the radical hotbed of the Northwest. Detroit was heavily pro-slavery, but it was also the grand terminus for the Underground Railroad because, of course, it's right on the border of Canada. And it had the most volatile and aggressive confrontations with slave catchers. And it was an open secret that Sojourner Truth worked the underground in Detroit. Black men in Detroit had organized the African American Mysteries Order of the Men of Oppression. Using signs, signals, and codes, they trusted no one, black or white, who was ignorant of these gestures. And Sojourner's commitment to activism and shift to the abolitionist epicenter from east to west influenced her move to Michigan. But it was dangerous in the West, much more dangerous than in the East. Once in Indiana, in order to prevent bloodshed, she was forced to show her breasts to prove that she was a woman. And even in Michigan, which had many pro-slavery pockets, especially the college town of Ann Arbor, she was mobbed, and hot pepper was thrown in her face. After the election of Lincoln, she and other abolitionists refused to cease the movement against slavery because Lincoln vacillated on the issue. During the Civil War in 1862, Sojourner and her traveling companion Josephine Griffith went to Indiana again, and Indiana had a law that prohibited African-Americans from going into the state, that is, free African-Americans. So Sojourner Truth went to Michigan in 1862 anyway. She was pursued, pushed, shoved, mobbed, and arrested 6 times for being in the state. Still, she continued to speak, and the Copperheads, that is, pro-slavery Northerners, pursued her. It was, said Josephine Griffith to the newspaper, the battle of Sojourner Truth. If I were younger, she told a hostile audience, I would fly to the battlefield as a nurse and cook to help the Northern boys. And in a pinch, she added, I would put in a blow now and then. She was instantly surrounded by a drunken mob that cursed her and threatened her with tars and feathers, rails and shooting. They told Sojourner that if she spoke in the town hall, they would burn it down. Then I will speak to the ashes, she said. The Union Home Guard arrived to protect her, but she nonetheless had to stand trial for breaking the law. Josephine Griffin defended her admirably on 2 occasions on behalf of free speech. On 2 other occasions, the lawyers hired by the Democrats decided that they would rather get drunk, and Sojourner was released to the Home Guard. They gave 3 cheers for Sojourner, the Union, and free speech. No dog was ever hung to a bone as these hungry hounds to Sojourner Truth under the cover of law, Josephine wrote the Liberator. But attendance at our meetings was immense and encouraging. Nursing mothers sat through the meetings for 5 straight hours with their infants, feeding their infants, but taking no nourishment for themselves. And yet they said they were not tired. It was a harrowing tour, she said. The democracy had guns, and they threatened to blow out our brains. After this last bruising tour, Sojourner became gravely ill, and when the Emancipation Proclamation was finally signed, she was not expected to live. But live she did, and she went to Washington, met Abraham Lincoln, worked among the freed people for 2 years, and continued her activism. Her last struggle was to create a homeland for African Americans in the Washington, D.C. area in Kansas. And so she was a precursor to the Kansas movement in 1877. She spent a year in Kansas and went all over the West and the East with petitions because Congress, when she went to Congress, they told her that it was up to the people as to whether or not they would allow them to use government resources to transport people from Washington, D.C. to Kansas, where there was free land, and to set them up with housing. So she went to the people. She had friends in every state with petitions, and she would visit, give speeches, have the signatures gathered, and then send them to Washington. And she did this for 3 years, until her grandson, who traveled with her, became very ill, and he actually died of an aneurysm. And it was such a blow to her that she had a stroke. She continued her activism. She got over her stroke and after about a year, and she continued her activism. By then, it was 1877, and the Kansas movement from the Gulf states was in force, and she continued to go to Kansas to help publicized this movement. And her last struggle was over temperance. In 1881, she died in 1883. In 1881, she spoke before the Michigan legislature. And she spoke against capital punishment. They were in the process of passing a capital punishment law. And she spoke in favor of temperance. And one of the things she told them was, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth makes the whole world blind. And I'm sure some of you have heard that before, because Martin Luther King used to say that. Excuse me? Okay, so, and she said, we don't need to hang anybody. And when you kill people, when you murder people for murdering someone else in cold blood, then you murder in cold blood. And if you want to hang something, hang whiskey, because that is at the core of many of society's problems. That was in 1881, and that was her last public speech, but she continued to speak in Battle Creek at various places, and Sojourner died on November 26th in 1883. Now I want to take a couple of minutes to show some images. Eric, is he here? Thank you. Okay, can you do it? One of the reasons we have images of Sojourner, aside from the fact that she was very photogenic, and this is the beginning of photography, but besides those reasons, after her 1863 illness, it was unclear as to whether she would ever be able to go around speaking again. And she was very resourceful, very industrious, very independent. And so she came up with the idea, images were called shadows. I don't want, that's the last one. Go to the one you just said, the first one, yeah. Images were called shadows. And she had a phrase which was, I sell the shadow to support the substance. And because she became popular as a result of Harriet Beecher Stowe's article that I mentioned earlier, people wanted to have a picture of her. So she had these pictures made, and she would have her friends in Michigan write letters for her, and she would send people a picture, and she would say, you know, the picture cost 10 cents, and the postage cost 3 cents. So if you will send me that amount of money, then I will send you pictures. So that was her way of making money. And this image here is the first image of Sojourner Truth, and this was actually in 1850, and it was taken when she published her narrative. So this was her the frontispiece on her narrative. I don't want that. That's the last one. They don't have them in order. Okay, that's that. No, but they should be. That this is Mary Ann Shad Carey, who is part of my revisionist perspective, because Mary Ann Shad Carey was a prominent immigrationist. She moved to Canada in the 1850s and encouraged African Americans to flee the United States that has enslaved African Americans and settle in Canada. And she was one of the prime people in Canada who people who fled through the underground would go to. So she was a resource. She was also a friend of Sojourner Truth's. And one of the reasons she's important to my work is because the idea that Sojourner Truth was not close to other African Americans was simply not true. And the idea that middle-class blacks wanted nothing to do with Sojourner Truth was not true. Mary Ann Shad Carey was the daughter of one of the members of the Black Convention movement. She was well-educated, and she and Sojourner Truth worked together on the Underground Railroad. We'll just do them. That's Sojourner Truth's grandson, James Caldwell. That's not the one that I mentioned who died of an aneurysm. This was one who served in the Civil War. James Caldwell was in the 54th Massachusetts Colored Regiment. It was the regiment, the Glory Regiment. And he was taken prisoner after the battle, and he remained in Andersonville until the war was over, and he came back very badly maimed. We lose track of him after about 1867. That's Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, which is another aspect of my revisionist perspective. Many of you know Frances Ellen Watkins Harper as a famous novelist and poet. She was also one of the travelers of the abolitionist movement. She and Sojourner Truth traveled together. Frances was very young. She began working in the anti-slavery movement around 1854 in her 20s. But she and Sojourner traveled together in Ohio. And Frances Ellen Watkins was a poet and also worked as a domestic. In spite of the fact that she was well-educated, She was eloquent. She often worked as a domestic because it was the only kind of work she could get. And she used that money to help fund the underground. Okay, sorry these are out of order, but no, I don't want that one, I want the other one. This is, in the background, you can see a house. That is Sojourner Truth's house, or it was. That's her Northampton home. And the Northampton community is where she lived for 15 years. And the Northampton, Massachusetts is very proud of Sojourner. And they built that statue in front of the house. It's an amazing statue. I don't know if there's a statue of Sojourner Truth in the state of New York, but there is one in Northampton. This is Sojourner Truth's outfit when she was on the Indiana campaign. The only thing that's missing is the hat. If this were in color, you would see that it's red, white, and blue. The Union Home Guard wanted the anti-slavery ladies to dress her up to represent the Union and free speech. And she hated this outfit. But when she got back to Battle Creek and was having these pictures taken, her friends wanted her to take a picture that represented what she had been doing in Indiana. This is a picture that was taken posthumously of Sojourner Truth and Abraham Lincoln. She did have an audience, at least one audience with Abraham Lincoln that we know of, and he did show her the Bible that the people of Baltimore had bought him, which was a $550 Bible that was laden with gold and velvet. And she made the comment that this is most beautiful, but isn't it interesting that they're giving you a Bible when they weren't even allowed to read it? This is against the law for enslaved people to learn to read. And this picture was taken by an artist in Michigan. He took an image of Sojourner Truth, and he used Sojourner Truth's daughter Diana's hand, and then he took a picture of got a picture of Abraham Lincoln. This was shown at the Chicago Exposition in 1893. This is 10 years after Sojourner's death. Okay. This is a picture of Sojourner in traveling clothes. This is the way she dressed before her friends decided that they wanted her to have a more genteel image. And so usually the image we see of Sojourner Truth, she's in a black dress, she has on a Quaker collar, and she looks like a black Quaker. But actually what she wore when she was traveling was a waterproof vest, which is what she has there, a leather apron, and usually she wore dark green. This was a traveling outfit. This was taken in Battle Creek when she went to Detroit, and woman she stayed with there, who was a wealthy woman whose son-in-law owned the biggest photography studio in Detroit, the pictures were much more genteel and much more sedate. And then the ones with her with the knitting, sitting at a sort of an elegant table, that's where those were taken. That's Sojourner's signature. That's on the back of that Indiana photo. That's the first known attempt that we have of Sojourner trying to write her name. That's her carpet bag and her smoking pouch. Sojourner was a great smoker. She was 76 when she stopped smoking, and she stopped cold. She said that the spirit that speaks to me will tell me when it's time to stop. And the spirit spoke to her at 76, and she stopped, and she never craved a cigarette because Dutch women smoked. People had tried to get her to stop because these were reformers, and they didn't smoke. And yet Sojourner was always smoking. And she has great stories about it. When people would try to get her to stop, she'd say, well, the cars are segregated. I have to ride in railroad cars, and I have to ride in the Jim Crow car. Jim Crow cars originated in the North, not in the South. And I'm surrounded by people who smoke and spit, and so I smoke in self-defense. And the other story is that she was out in Wisconsin, and she was on the anti-slavery circuit with a group of Quakers, and one Quaker, who Quakers are very, very straight-laced, they were on the porch, and she was in a rocking chair smoking her Dutch pipe, and he said, Sojourner, you believe in the Bible? And she said, yes, I believe I do. She says, do you believe what's in the Bible? She said, yes. He says, well, the Bible says that nothing unclean can enter the kingdom of heaven, and there's nothing as unclean as a smoker's breath. So what do you think of that? And so she said, well, when it's time for me to go to heaven, I'm going to leave my breath behind. That's okay. That's just another of her images, her more sedate images. But it still wasn't good enough for the Detroit Quakers. They wanted her in black. They had trouble getting her to wear black because she didn't like black. She associated black with death. But she finally decided that it was the more sedate image, and so she went along with it. But that's another Battle Creek image. And that's her Detroit image. That's the famous one of her sitting there with her knitting and the flowers and her Quaker garb. Okay. That's a picture of Douglas when he met Sojourner Truth. One of my other revisionist perspectives is that Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass were not good friends. They were very close friends. They traveled together. They were really the two most prominent black abolitionists during the era. And Douglass would quote Sojourner Truth. Now, he certainly had a superior attitude toward her. He called her, he said, she was the perfect example of the uncultured Negro. And he also said that she was full of wild enthusiasm and flint-like common sense. And he said that she seemed to please herself and others most when she put her ideas in the oddest form. And it wasn't that she was putting her ideas in odd form, it's just that English was her second language, and so she sometimes interpreted English differently from the way a native speaker would. But Douglass and Sojourner were very close friends, but he did recognize, or he did believe, that she was uncultured, and she seemed to, as he said, she liked to trip me up when I was trying to behave like a gentleman of cultivation and refinement. That's another picture of her house in Northampton. Preview has new dialogue. If you just show that last one, okay. Preview has new dialogue. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so this is the last one. This is the last image of Sojourner Truth, taken in the spring of 1883. So it's several months before she died. She had been ill. And I chose this because it's the oldest picture of Sojourner, and it has to do with age. And it's a good way to talk about the age issue. Sojourner was always made to be older than she was. She died at 86. She was born in 1797. And yet, her northeastern friends insisted on making her 10, sometimes 20 years older than she actually was. And at first, she would try and tell them how old she was, but because she couldn't read and write, they didn't believe her. And so she finally just stopped trying. And so the newspapers would call her, for instance, Sojourner Truth, that old relic. Well, in fact, she was only about 55 when they were saying these things. And so she finally just got tired of it. But one of the things that really vexed her was the age question. By the way, when she died, her best friend and biographer had put on her headstone 106 as her age, to give you an idea of the issues that they had. And there's an actual reason for why they felt this way. But she knew how old she was. And the question vexed her. And so, like she did with the smoking, she found ways to make light of it. At one point, when she was in Washington with her petitions in the 1870s, she loved to sit in court and listen to court proceedings. So a newspaper editor saw her in there, and he went up to her and he said, "Are you Sojourner Truth?" And she said, "Yes." And so he said, "Can I interview you?" And so she said, "Well, yeah, if you'll sign my petition." So he signed the petition. And she said, "Now, we can't interview here. You can go to my quarters." So he accompanied her to her very nice quarters, and she took off her bonnet. And the first question he said was, "How old are you?" And so she said, "Well, bless you, child. You know, the other day, I was waiting to see President Grant." And Sojourner met three presidents. "And I met a nice-looking, settled, colored man. I'm looking to get married again, so I don't tell my age." And then the final comment was that when she was in her last year of life, her doctor was John Harvey Kellogg, the founder of the Cornflakes. And he was attending her one evening, and he said to her, "How old are you, Sojourner?" And she looked at him with a twinkle in her eye, and she said, "Why should I tell you my age? It might spoil my chances with you." Okay, that's it. Thank you very much for your attention. Sorry about the technical difficulties, but... So if you have a few questions, I'd be glad to...
There actually might be a statue in New York City. I'm not sure if it's Harry Tubman, but I've seen it many times. It's on Frederick Douglass.
I know there isn't one in New York City.
So it's
it must be somebody else. Huh? There's a bust in Washington.
No, but there is a full statue figure.
In New York City?
I'll make sure. I'll Google it.
Because I've been in New York City many times.
It's 116 on Frederick Douglass. There's a new statue that's been installed.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's right. But anyway, thank you so much. And any questions?
I went outside briefly because I wanted to ask you to expand more. I don't know what, but on the relationship between Sojourner and Douglass, but I think you picked it up later on. Mm-hmm. It wasn't too, was it as conflictual as people might think? That's what you're
no, saying. No, I was saying that they were good friends.
That's right.
But yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned something different. Differences, but differences.
There were differences. They did have, they had ideological differences.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other question I have, just seeing the images of Sojourner and dancing there, I saw images of Harriet. I know she was. She was born, Harriet was born in 1820, Sojourner 1797, so she was 20-something years younger.
Yes, she was younger.
Did they pass across?
Yes, they did.
I don't know if you did mention that when I was on.
I didn't mention that, but their paths did.
Since we're here, particularly here, just tell us how relevant we are.
Their paths did cross. You know, that's the question is when. And I don't know when, and so I didn't say when in my book. The other two biographers did say when, and they're wrong. Because I know where Sojourner Truth was then, and she was not anywhere near where Harriet Tubman was. But in her dictated narrative, Harriet Tubman says that she and Sojourner Truth met, but she just doesn't say where. And somehow, quite some time ago, I think it was in the 1940s, when a biographer wrote a book about Harriet Tubman, he made the mistake of saying that they met in Boston in 1863. Sojourner Truth was on her deathbed in 1863. And then the other historians just picked that up, which is kind of how things get going. But they did meet. Al?
From Professor Washington, you say with quite certainty that she was born in 1797. What are the records that indicate that?
We don't have a birth certificate because she was enslaved. What she says is that she was born 2 years before her first master died. And that's what her parents told her. Her first master died in 1799. And so that's how we come up with 1797. Her owner, her last owner, John Dumont, said that he was told that she was 12 when he purchased her. And so that would put her birth year at 1797. And then there are a couple of other piece of evidence is that Isaac Van Wagenen, the man who bought her from Dumont, they'd known each other since birth. They were both born in 1797. And he says that, I didn't talk about this in the presentation, but she gets involved in a murder case. And she has to go to Ulster County and get character references. And one of her character references is Isaac Van Wagenen. And that's what he says. Not as far as I know. Not as far as I know. And it's interesting because we're not even sure that her father was half Mohawk, because the abolitionists didn't talk about that. It was only the Westerners, the people in the Midwest, who started saying that her father was half Mohawk. And when she's in Indiana, the reports in the newspapers that come out of Indiana say that Sojourner Truth was a cross between an African and an Indian. So she apparently has this heritage, but it was something that the abolitionists were about anti-slavery. They didn't want to talk about any Indian impact. But from what we know about her father's background and about her first owners, they were Indian traders, and her first owner spoke several Indian languages. So could he have gotten this boy, and he was a boy, her father was a boy when he got him. Could he have gotten him from an Indian group? Possibly. So that's really all we know about any relationship with Native Americans. Yeah,
I'm
Carol?
I'm interested in your research pattern for obvious reasons, and I'm trying to see what sources you used and how long.
Well, you know, I began with their narrative, because I wanted to substantiate the narrative, because a lot of the literary scholars said that it was abolitionist propaganda, and so I went to Ulster County, looked at a lot of wills, I looked at tax records, wills and tax records, and then I looked at the diaries of some of the Dutchmen in the region, so that's how I began with part one, which deals with her life in Ulster County among the Dutch. And then for her years in New York City, she actually dictated a narrative before she dictated her slave narrative about her experiences in New York City, and that provided me with a lot of clues that were at the New York Historical Society, like looking at some of the people she worked with in New York City, looking at the Methodist Church records, looking at the African Methodist Zion Church records. And then with the anti-slavery movement, she dictated a lot of letters that friends wrote for her. Her grandson wrote for her later on. This is after 1863. Newspapers loved Sojourner Truth. They were very impressed with her speeches, and they were kind of amazed by her dialect. And so they were always publishing what she said. And then the anti-slavery newspapers also covered her. And because she traveled so much, and she was the only black woman on the circuit until Frances Watkins came, and that was in the mid-1850s. So actually, I found more than I expected to find about Sojourner Truth. And what else did I use? I used newspapers, wills, diaries. People wrote a lot about Sojourner, and letters, lots of letters. People, she had friends all over the country, and they kept in touch with each other about what she was doing, where she was, you know. Sojourner is up now, she's able to walk without a cane. Just giving information about her. Since she moved to Michigan, her Boston friends wanted to know how she was doing. So that was an important source of information. And there were even, I even found a couple of sources, I shouldn't say a couple, maybe six or seven sources in England. Because the British anti-slavery movement was very strong. And as a matter of fact, when she was ill in 1863 and she was getting all this attention, she had someone dictate a letter and to say how heartwarming it was for people to be remembering her. And she said, who ever heard of Sojourner Truth in Ireland? But she was getting mail from people in Ireland. And George Thompson, who was a member of Parliament, who traveled with her in 1851, came to America during the Civil War and brought her address that was given to him to give to Sojourner by Queen Victoria. Now, it's fun. The dress is in a case in Battle Creek, Michigan, and the dress is for someone who's about 5'2". So she never wore it, but there it is. So she was very well known. Well, there are actually quite a lot of differences. For one thing, I have one full part on Sojourner Truth's life as a Dutch, African Dutch woman, because I think that you really do have to go back to her roots in Ulster County. And so that's one thing that I think is really important. And but I think in terms of Sojourner Truth, as we have come to know her, that I think Nell's point is that Sojourner was a creation of white society, especially white women. And so she was a symbol. And she was a symbol for white women because they didn't want to deal with middle-class black women. So it was easier for them to deal with an uneducated black woman who didn't make too much sense. And so one of the reasons I was reading from her speeches at these two black churches was to show that people took Sojourner Truth seriously. And she did have very close relationships with white women. There's no question about that. But that's not all she was close to other black women as well. She was not, I mean, you know, the middle class black America was not activist. The middle class black America was like any middle class. They're interested in themselves. But there were significant people who were involved in activism. And Sojourner Truth worked with those people. So, I mean, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and Mary Ann Shadd, the Fortin women, these were all friends of Sojourner Truth, and they're all middle-class women. The Fortins were very wealthy people, but they were activists. So I think that we do Sojourner Truth a disservice. I think Nell did her a disservice by not taking her seriously. And so, I mean, when I began this book, I wasn't thinking about revising Nell Painter because I began it before her book came out. But when I read her book, I just said, well, I knew that what she said couldn't be true because I'd already published a narrative and I'd done all this research on the narrative. But knowing it instinctively and proving it are two different things. So that's what I set out to do. But that, I think, is the fundamental difference, is that I think that Sojourner Truth was a very, very important historical figure in her own right.
Be of interest is just a comment, because Sojourner Truth has an afterlife, especially in the Albanian, especially among a group that call themselves Afro-Futurists.
Call themselves what?
Afro-Futurists.
Okay.
So it's part of this Afro-Futurist movement, mostly in new media art and mostly by Black and diaspora. And it had to do with the, with her status as so-called slave in relation to the slave as a whole, in terms of labor, that it's controlled, but it's also could just confront you. And put this, and just to give you an example, what is funny when I'm reading just the first just few pages, the process of self-name, which is interesting, part of her compassion resistance. But the way she had that encounter between her and the Quaker, and how in the process she named herself Sojourner Truth. The project, I think it was a public just education project called Outreach, where there was a kid in high school in, or maybe a little school in Texas, named the robot that was made by the coordinator professor here, Steve Squire. It was named after Sojourner Truth.
Yes, I remember that. I remember that, yeah.
So that started another, that was what triggered some of these Afro features, conceptual art. To do it, and one of them did a project, it's an Android project on that, and his justification of it is that she, the slave, could control the labor, but then could also disappear, and that is referencing her underground labor. And the other one did a sculpture project called the Sojourner, that's actually a miniature imitation of the street choir, but it was a play on the same idea of Sojourner Truth and how the irony of her landing in Mars and then also disappearing, because after a while the connection is
her. Yes, right, yeah, that's right. She had the name. She was traveling, and I mean, it was a great idea, except that, that's right, it was lost.
I just thought I should mention this, like an afterlife of her work in the future. Anyway, any other questions? Well, thank you so much. The books are outside.
Thank you.